We know many of you listen to this podcast on the go, driving to work, working out, even doing chores. Now you can get CPE credit for that time. With Earmark, you can earn free NASBA-approved CPE for listening to the Inside Public Accounting podcast. After you listen to an episode, take a quiz, and your certificate will be ready. Earmark has courses for everyone in your firm, from staff to partners. Get started today at earmark.app or download the free app on the App Store.
Today on the Inside Public Accounting podcast, we're joined by somebody whose influence in the accounting world is very hard to overstate. I looked recently on LinkedIn, and Alan Colton, of all people, called this guy a Hall of Famer. It's Jeffrey Wern. A good day to you, sir.
Good day to you as well.
Jeffrey, I'm going to read something out here because you're probably very modest and can't even remember all the accolades that you've been through. But let me just set the audience up with this. You served as CEO of Marcum for more than 30 years, so you've got longevity in the game. And fair to say, it was a regional player, Jeffrey. You took it into the big leagues, didn't you?
Well, we grew the firm significantly. I think right before we sold it to CBiz late last year, we were in the top 15 in the country. So we had a nice ride.
Sure. And the Inside Public Accounting podcast is very much about the stories behind the numbers. So let's give this a little bit of context here. Marcum landed on the top 100 list in 1998. That seems like an age ago. Coming in at number 81 with 11.5 million in revenue. That must seem like small beans, Jeffrey, right now. But you took it in 2024 to the 13th largest in the country, and that went to 1.3 billion. So that is a major uplift. Under your leadership, I'm going to say this for you because you perhaps wouldn't admit this, but Marcum grew through bold acquisitions, innovative thinking, and a relentless focus on people and culture. I want to talk to you about branding and culture today, because I know it's very dear to your heart, but you did. You were brave. You built a brand that stood out, and it remains today under CBiz, client-focused, entrepreneurial, future-ready. So we're going to go in this episode, Jeffrey, and dip behind the M&A story and the headlines, and I want to talk to you about what it really takes to build a brand in this profession, maybe some of the hard lessons, mistakes you made along the way. And we're aiming this at not just firm leaders, but managing partner future leaders, people that want to peek behind the curtain of some of the big success stories. So let's kick off. Jeffrey, when it comes to your legacy, what do you think you want to be known for? If there's a tombstone, a gravestone, and you finally rattle off and go up to heaven or wherever you go, what might you want people saying about you?
You know, that's an interesting question. I guess as we created a firm that focused on the people and the clients, you know, again, last year when we sold, we employed over 4,000 people. So I would just like to think that people will remember us for what we achieved, the platform we gave people to flourish in, and that we gave our clients good service. You know, but hopefully this firm and the combination with CBiz will far outlast me. And by the time I'm gone, nobody will remember what I actually did back then.
Well, that's a legacy, something that lives on after you've gone. They might not know your name, but you'll certainly be in the annals and the recordings that the curators will record. Do you think the Marcum story could be done again today, Jeffrey? Because the game's changed a little bit, hasn't it?
Oh, I think it certainly could be done again today. I like to tell people we accomplished what we did, but it was an overnight success that took 43 years. And if we actually knew we could have accomplished it, we probably could have done it in a shorter time frame. But, you know, starting when we did and having the small firm frame of reference, if you told me when I joined Marcum in 1981, when there were six people there and $300,000 of revenue, that we could grow it to a $1.3 billion firm, I couldn't have even fathomed that. So, I think the transition in the profession has created opportunities for future leaders and future accounting entrepreneurs that didn't exist when I joined Marcum & Kligman back in 1981.
Well, if you think about what didn't exist in 1981, there were no iPhones, there was no internet, there was no email, there was certainly no AI. We'd just about gone into spreadsheets, maybe. So it was a very primitive game, it seems, back then to be playing.
Yeah, and the big thing is there was no outside capital. You know, the accounting, while it's a profession, is a business now that's recognized by more than just the profession. But, you know, it is quickly becoming a business similar to any other business you see out there, especially with the, you know, the real change in 2021 when private equity discovered the accounting industry, I'll call it.
Well, you're not shy of answering the tough questions. So if I were to say to you, private equity, a force for good or a force for evil, on which side would you land?
I think it's certainly a force for good. I think it raises the bar on all of us. I mean, you know, private equity firms are very interesting, but at the end of the day, they want to make money for their investors. They want to do it right. They don't want to get in trouble. They want to be professional. And the good private equity firms have a history of buying good companies. They don't want to run them. They don't know how to run our companies. They know how to make good investments and back good management teams. But their objective is not to come in and tell you how to run the business. They want you to deliver the business plan you sold them.
Sure.
But I think private equity is something that makes everybody up their game and be accountable. And, you know, accountability was one of the main themes at Marcum for all those years.
Well, let's talk about the brand of Marcum, because you were very consistent from the beginning, it seems, because Marcum expanded across countries, cultures, boundaries, specialties, but maintained a certain consistency in its brand. Is that something you set out from the outset to curate, or is that something that happens along the way?
No, that was part of the plan, and building the brand, creating the brand, having people know the brand was instrumental in being able to accomplish what we did. You know, when you walk into somebody's door, whether it's an M&A target, whether it's a new client, and they know your name, that puts down a lot of barriers. Mm. And just knowing the name gives you a degree of credibility where if people don't know your name, like, who's Marcum? And, you know, at the time, and I think it's still true today, there's over 44,000 accounting firms in the U.S. If people don't know your name, you're in that traffic of all the unknowns. So building your brand and having people recognize the brand, they don't even have to know how they know you. They just know your name. And that's some type of credibility. It's like, well, I know Marcum. I don't know how I know them, but I know the name.
Yeah. That's so well said. It's like a reputation, isn't it? It goes into the room before you. So your people are forearmed, forewarned. They know of you. The conversation's a little bit warmer. So when we talk about a brand in accounting, we could talk about the brand of Nike or Coca-Cola or the big players like that. Accounting firms, they're a little bit more difficult to brand because they don't claim the same values. We value our clients. We're tech-centric. We're people-focused. All of these things. How do you articulate a brand for an accounting firm?
It's funny. All people have to do is know the name. You have to build the name. You have to build awareness. As I said, there's 44,000 accounting firms. There are less than 50 that have a national or international brand.
Okay.
There may be less than 20. Mm. So if you can become one of those, you know, when we were going through the process of deciding whether to sell the company or not, we hired an investment banker. And one of the bankers always used to say in pitch meetings that Marcum punches above its weight class because, you know, we were the 13th largest firm, but our brand was recognized with Grant Thornton and BDO and PwC and EY. You know, our brand was much bigger than our company. And if you can achieve that, if as you pointed out, if you can walk in the door and people know your name, the defenses are down. It's not like, who are these people? Oh, we know them. Mm-hmm. So there's some credibility attached, whether it's warranted or not. But there's credibility attached when you walk in a room and people know your name.
You must be dismayed, though, Jeffrey, when you look around. You talked about so many firms out there. They have the same website, the same logos, the same fonts, the same colors on their site. They make the same claims. A brand is a lot more than a logo and a website, isn't it? It's a lot deeper.
Yeah. You know, to me, it was a simple, stupid thing. People had to know your name, and then you had to deliver on the expectation.
Well, you got to associate that name with something, haven't you?
Yeah. they have to associate with you, with the industry you're in, the services you provide, the quality of the services. But, you know, it's too often you see a lot of noise. And yeah. Whether it's in commercials, whether it's in billboards, whether it's in print ads. And I was always one to say, I don't really care about any of it. It's like less is more to me. And my sole objective was for people to see Markham in his big as letters as I could put them, and with the simple tagline, accountants and advisors. I wanted people to know the name and what we did. So whether it was TV commercials, and I can talk about that, or billboards or print advertising or rolling transportation. We used to wrap these huge buses, and CBiz still does it around the country. All I wanted to do was have a 40-foot rolling billboard that said Markham across the whole side. You know, it didn't need to say anything else. There was no messaging, you know, and when we started this, we were looking to enhance and have people know the brand. You know, we weren't advertising with a message, with a call to action. We weren't, you know, there wasn't, you know, get on the Markham website and get this coupon. Yeah. There wasn't a sale on tax returns this week. It was all geared to having people know the name. So, for example, we did TV commercials. The only thing that mattered to me in the commercials were the last 6 or 7 seconds when the announcer would come on and say, where do all the people with all the answers get all the answers? Ask Markham, accountants and advisors. That's the only thing that mattered. So I just, and you would see a big Markham for 6 or 7 seconds at the end of the commercial. And that was the only thing that mattered to me.
I'm bewildered by the courage that you had to go all out like that. But I'm also mindful of the audience that will be listening to this, thinking, well, it's okay for Markham. If you've got a big war chest, you can throw 8 million and advertise at the Super Bowl. You can run TV ads. You can be on every billboard you like if you've got the depth and marketing budget of a Nike or a big four firm. So square that circle for us. More money, better marketing, or is it more than the money?
No, we didn't always have that war chest. I mean, right. You know, we grew. And part of how we grew was, you know, we grew into some of these things. But, you know, we weren't always a $1.3 billion firm. If you go back to, we started our national or international expansion in 2008. In 2008, we were a $100 million firm, but fortunately, we were always profitable. We were always well capitalized, and we always reinvested money in the business. While we, you know, the key tenets of our reinvestment were talent and technology, we also invested money in branding and image. So, you know, we didn't become a $1 billion firm by not reinvesting in the $100 million firm. Or as you pointed out in 1998, I guess your numbers are right, but, you know, $11 million at that point. You know, we always reinvested in the firm and built the firm.
There's a lesson there. You anchored the conversation with 2008. I know that was the year the iPhone came out. We were also on the dawn of a recession at that point. But it seems the message here is wherever you are, you never not invest in marketing.
You have to invest in marketing. You have to invest in your brand. You have to invest in your company. And we always looked, I always looked at it like the advice we were giving our clients. You have to build retained earnings. You have to leave money in the company. And if you want to grow, you have to, you know, there's a delicate balance between taking all the profits out and leaving enough in to grow to get to the next level. But if you don't invest in your own business, nobody else is going to do that.
Well, that is so true. What about the smaller firms, the mid-tier firms? They obviously don't have the budgets, but they can still build a brand without access to huge funds like that. Talk about how they might go around that, Jeffrey.
Well, listen, they may not have the same budget, but they can allocate the same percentage of their revenue or profits. And it's a building process. You know, you don't get from 0 to 100 automatically. It's not a God-given right. You need to work it. You need to invest. And, you know, people are always saying they don't have capital. They need outside investments. They need, someone has to invest in their business to help them grow. Well, invest in your own business and don't take all the money out quicker than you're making it. Don't take out 100%. Reinvest in your own business.
Accountants should know this, Jeffrey. It's 101, isn't it?
Well, that's what I said before. We looked at our business like the advice we gave our clients.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd be surprised how in my travels, and you know, we did over 40 transactions at Markham. You'd be surprised how financially unsophisticated most accounting firms are about their own businesses.
Mm. Was there a magic number when you say you put a proportion into marketing and branding? Did you work with a certain figure or percentage?
Well, I'd say we were backwards. We always knew what bottom line we wanted. Uh-huh. You know, there are statistics on that. Then you got to be careful because people could say you need to spend 5% on marketing. Well, you know, then it depends what's in the 5%. You know, how much do you spend on technology? And some people would include the copy machine rentals and, you know, stuff like that in technology. So you got to be careful about what's in what bucket. But it's more about, and Markham, we were funny. Again, we were financially successful. So we didn't have an overly complicated budgeting process. And we decided to do TV commercials when we felt we were big enough. But it was never, oh, this is X percentage of our revenue. Same thing with billboards, same thing with print media. We were always probably spending more than we should have, but we knew it would pay a dividend.
Mm. I'm smiling because I remember the famous quote by David Ogilvy of Ogilvy & Mather, the big advertising agency, that said, we know that 50% of our advertising works. We just don't know which 50%. So you must have been putting money into schemes and campaigns and not always knowing that they would pay off.
We never knew. It was all anecdotal. Again, it wasn't a call to action. So we didn't have an 800 number and we weren't selling potato peelers.
Right.
And we could identify which TV show, where they called from, and how many potato peelers we sold. It was all anecdotal. But, you know, it felt good to us. Business was continually increasing. People would say, hey, I saw your commercial. Or, you know, they'd walk up to us and say, oh, you're the Ask Markham people. Or what should I ask you?
That must have felt good, though.
Right. So we had anecdotal evidence, but it was just part of our, I would say, values and culture to spend money building the brand. You know, we wanted people to know us. We wanted people to know the name because we knew when we walked in the room and they already knew who we are, the barriers to entry were less.
Yeah. Was there ever any pushback from partners, equity holders, saying we shouldn't spend so much on marketing, we want to take a little bit more out of the pot?
No, because they understood it was part of the growth and part of the strategy. And, you know, they were doing okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think people were proud of it also. Mm. You know, they were proud to be a Markham partner, a Markham associate. And the branding, when you work for a company that people know the name instead of the other 43,980 accounting firms that nobody knew the name, you know, people were proud to work for Markham. We had a name, we had recognition. You know, we made getting clients easier, recruiting people easier. So we built that. That was all part of it.
Mm. Let's pivot to the mergers. You mentioned there are 40 acquisitions across your tenure there. You were definitely a pioneer because M&A hasn't come into fashion until the last few years, but you were back there doing it. But I'm reminded that pioneers are often found face down in the dirt with arrows in their back, and you must have taken a lot of risks there. Just talk us through some of the lessons, maybe the tough lessons that you learned about that journey, protecting, evolving the brand, making the right acquisitions.
Well, you never know if it's the right acquisition until you're done.
Yeah.
You know, 'cause you never know anyone until you live with them. But I'd say a couple of things is, you know, in the beginning when we would do an acquisition or a merger, we'd be very sensitive about the name of the firm that was merging in or we were buying. In the early days, we would co-brand, merged a firm in California in 2010 called Stonefield Josephson. So for the first year, we were called Markham Stonefield because we, you know, the Stonefield people loved their brand. Markham was not known in California. I think our deal with them was we would co-brand for a year and then it would go to the Markham brand. Well, 6 months into the deal, I went to Ron Friedman, who was running the firm at that point, and we looked at each other and said, we don't have to wait a year. This was a stupid idea. So I would say that, you know, one of the lessons learned was while you may be merging or buying strong local brands, change the name day one. Markham was nationally recognized. Stonefield was California. In hindsight, and after that, I think we went to, you know, the first couple of deals, 2008, 2009, 2010, we did this co-branding because it seemed right at the time and deferential to the people we were merging with. Sure. But after then, we realized that, we just changed the name up front.
Yeah. I'm fascinated in how culture figured in your merging strategy, because you can throw a Coca-Cola in with the Panda Pops, and they are two very different cultures, and yet it's hard to put culture into due diligence. Intangible, isn't it? It's very difficult to get a handle on, but presumably merging cultures was important to you.
Well, it wasn't culture, it was values.
Right.
And, you know, I've said this before, the culture in New York, when we were where we were based, and places like Miami, Florida, which was one of our first acquisitions, and Orange County, California, or Portland, Maine, or any of these locations, you have a different culture. We used to do networking events in New York. We called them Martinis with Markham.
Ooh,
well,
lovely.
In Irvine, California, they were Margaritas with Markham.
Yes.
It was the same concept, but did I care whether it was Martinis or Margaritas? I wanted the networking event. So you have to allow for cultural differences, especially regional. You know, pre-COVID, I wore a shirt and tie 5 days a week. My partner in Orange County wore a Tommy Bahama shirt. It didn't make it any less effective or successful. It was just in California, they were wearing Tommy Bahama shirts. And in New York, I was, you know, in a corporate office on Third Avenue in a shirt and tie.
Yeah.
It's just different culture. But the value system was the thing. We had 9 core values at Markham. Things like independence and integrity and firm first and giving back and, you know, things like that. The value system was the important consistency across the firm, no matter where you were. There could be cultural differences.
But wouldn't most firms claim to espouse those values of integrity and honesty and client first? You can't all have the same things, or did just some firms do it better than others?
I think firms do it better than others. And I think, you know, it's when stuff happens that it's a true test of whether the firm lives up to those values or not. And, you know, when a big client comes in and wants you to do something you shouldn't do, and you're big enough to say no, and you have your integrity and you have your objectivity and you have your independence, that's the true test. And, you know, we were always, you know, lived up to our values, and there was never any client or partner or employee that was bigger than the firm. And, you know, we always believed if you take care of the firm, it would take care of you, but don't do anything to put the firm at risk. And I would get up at firm meetings and talk about the Arthur Andersen debacle that happened in the 2000s and how one office destroyed a great firm, and that you always have to put the firm first and everything will work out after that.
Well, you preempted me a little bit there. I know you're humble enough to talk about failure, and it wouldn't have been an easy ride. It wouldn't have been an upward graph the whole time. What about the scoops, Jeffrey? What about the regrets? What about the big mistakes along the way? Would you share any of those?
Yeah, and I think most of the mistakes are people related. We're all going to make mistakes. I equate accounting firms to baseball teams.
Okay.
You know, there's 9 people on the field. They're not all the shortstop batting fourth, but the best hitters in the major leagues hit the ball, get on base 1 out of 3 times.
Yeah.
That means they're striking out or fouling out or, you know, getting put out at a base 2 out of 3 times. So if you're going to do things, you're going to make mistakes. So you have to accept that as part of what happens. So you mentioned Alan Colton before. Alan and I used to talk all the time about good deals, deals we lost. And, you know, I always used to say to Alan, you have to be able to take a punch. Because if you're going to get punched and fall down and not get back up and get back in, but I'd say the key is admitting it to yourself. You're going to make mistakes. And if you're afraid to make mistakes, you can't be entrepreneurial. You can't lead. You shouldn't run a business. When you make mistakes, you got to do a couple of things. First, you got to admit it to yourself. Everybody around you knows you made a mistake. It's very funny. These are not secrets. And Like I said, we did 40 deals. Not all of them were perfect. Some of them had some hair on them, and they were mostly related to people. Nobody is, you're doing an acquisition or you're doing a merger. The person you're sitting across from is not telling you all the bad people he has with him.
No.
He's hoping you're going to fix his problems, except they don't tell you that. Yeah. So then you wind up figuring out the problems. So you've got to admit your mistakes, and then you got to go fix them. You know, don't die with your mistakes. And when you do that, just like a baseball team, your business team will rally around you. People will help you. You know, they know you made a mistake. They're hoping you know you made a mistake. They'll do everything they can to help you fix the mistake.
Yeah.
People are very good like that. But, you know, you can't just think because it was your decision, it was the right decision, or it was a good deal.
That's very honest. Tell us about your leadership style, Jeffrey. We know there are so many different kinds of leaders, and you'll have had mentors and people you'd stood on the shoulders of to get where you are. So how would you encapsulate your approach, your style of leadership?
Oh, that's funny. It's amazing what I would say versus people who worked with me would say. You know, it depends on who you are and how good you are. But, you know, my management style changed as we evolved. You know, you remember I left this leadership role a year ago. I just turned 68.
Okay.
So when I started running Marcum, I was in my 30s. You know, 30-year-olds are different emotionally and intellectually than 60-year-olds.
So true.
So my style changed over the years. You know, 35-year-old Jeff Weider wasn't as emotionally secure, financially secure, generally secure as 35-year-old Jeff Weiner was. I like to tell people you change every 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, you're a different person. So pick a number, 10 years earlier, 10 years later, things change. But I used to give people, I was not a micromanager. I used to hire really smart people. I always believed you had to surround yourself with people smarter than you. I mean, I knew how to run the business, but I'm certainly not an auditor. I'm not a tax person. I'm not a technology person. I know enough to be dangerous with all of those things, but I always surrounded myself with people that were smarter in those disciplines than I was. And then I empowered them to do their job. I worked with them. I held them accountable. We agreed on direction and finances and things like that. But you have to hire smarter people than you and let them go do their job. And I'd like to think it was a culture that empowered really good people. Marcum wasn't for everybody. And the good, hardworking, accountable people thrived. And the people who thought, you know, coming to work was, you know, something they had to do that they didn't want to do. And no matter what they did, they were going to be successful. Didn't work out that well.
No.
So it was one of empowering people to be, I would like to think at Marcum, people were pushed to perform on a level they wouldn't have done on their own.
Talk to us about life now, Jeffrey. You are humble enough to say you're 68 now. You've obviously had a really easy life because you've got no wrinkles and no gray hairs or a very good skincare regime. The life's been good to you, but obviously tough things going along the way. What does life look like for you now a year after stepping away?
Well, I'm still, you know, I still do some work for CBiz. I have a consulting agreement with them for 2 years. So I spend some time with Jerry Grisco, who's our CEO, when he needs me to do whatever he, you know, projects he needs me to do. I'm involved in a family business with one of my sons. We own some car dealerships in the New York area. I've gotten a little involved or more involved in some charity and not-for-profit endeavors. But, you know, it's certainly a lot less stress not being responsible for 4,000 people. The toughest part about running a business like Marcum was I was responsible for 4,000 paychecks, which equates to probably, if you take 4,000 people, the average family was 3 or 4 people.
Yeah.
We were feeding 12,000 people a day. Mm-hmm. We were paying 4,000 rents or mortgages. We were probably paying, you know, somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 car payments. You just realize what the responsibility is in making sure all these people get paid twice a month. So it wasn't hard work. It was a lot of responsibility. Now I get up and I have to worry about my wife and our 5 children. And it doesn't go much past that.
No.
So the responsibility, you know, the weight of that responsibility has been lifted. But, you know, I do things like this. I'm still somewhat involved. I believe truly entrepreneurial people never retire.
No.
They change their job. They change their job description. But when we were going through the sale process and it was becoming a reality that we were potentially selling Markham, my wife Tracy looked at me and said, "You could do whatever you want, but you still need to leave the house by 9 o'clock in the morning and you can't come home before 6 o'clock at night. So do whatever you want, but you can't stay here.
Get under my feet." Yes. I've been used to not having you around, right?
Exactly. And so I'm fortunate that I have things to do that get me out of the house a bunch of days a week.
But you've earned the right to have life on your terms, for sure. I'm just thinking of some of the Hollywood actors and the big celebrities that they come to that point in their life, Jeffrey, where the phone stops ringing. And it's a fight for relevance. Now, you've proved everything you need to prove, but you still want to be in the game to an extent. You still want to mentor, you want to coach, you want to advise. You've got a lot going on up here that you want to speak into the lives of people on. So that phone's still ringing for you.
It's ringing, but not as much as it used to, but that's okay.
Yeah.
There's other. Listen, I've played more golf since November 1st than I did in the 3 years before.
Sure.
So this, if you have interests, fortunately, I have a lot of outside interests besides just going to work. I always did. So I'm going to the gym more than I did. I'm playing golf more than I did. I'm still working. I'm still involved in things. But it's a more balanced life. And again, I don't have the responsibility.
No. And you're certainly not sat at home watching daytime TV eating tacos, because Tracy would not be happy with that.
No, I have to go elsewhere to do that.
Jeffrey, a couple more questions. This is such a wonderful experience for me and our audience here. If you were starting a firm from scratch in today's environment, what would you do differently?
Oh, what would I do differently? I think it really comes down to realizing what you can accomplish. In 1981, when I started at Markham, I had no idea what I could accomplish. And it took a while to realize it. I'd certainly surround myself with really good people. You know, you have to realize it's not all about you, which I realized early on. I realized I only had so many hours to work. I can only bill so much for my own time. And I only knew so much. You know, I wasn't the smartest guy in the room. I may have been the most driven. I may have been the most entrepreneurial. But, you know, I wasn't the smartest guy in the room. Surround yourself with good people and don't sell yourself short on what you can accomplish. I didn't start out building a business. I started out as an accountant. Then I realized I could make accounting a business and build it. I always learned from other people. I always went to, whether it was AICPA meetings, the practice management meetings, the major firms meetings. I learned every meeting I went to, I learned something. So things to do and things not to do.
Yeah.
You know, this is most businesses, unless you're creating Facebook or unless you're creating an electric vehicle like Tesla, or unless you're really innovating, if you're going to go into a business like accounting that has been around for decades, if not longer, you learn lessons on what to do and what not to do. And you don't have to make the same mistakes other people before you made. Learn from their mistakes and also learn from their successes. Mm. You don't necessarily have to have an original thought. All you have to do is copy the successes, stay away from the failures, and you can do very well. But you have to know what you want, but don't make it all about you. Surround yourself with really good people. Understand your role. They will also, not everybody wants to run a business. Not everybody wants to be a leader, but some people want to run an audit department. Some people want to create technology. Some people want to run an office or a region. Not everybody wants to be the guy responsible for everything or the girl responsible for everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, surround yourself by really good people and always never take out more than you're making. Always reinvest.
Very sound. Final question, Jeffrey. You've seen a lot of things change over the years. You've been in the game a long time, multiple cycles, trends, shifts, seasons. Let's get your crystal ball out to finish off. Well, let's take you to Vegas and give me a couple of predictions that you'd put everything on black or red on, or you'd bet your house on, that might define the next era of public accounting. What's definitely going to happen, do you think?
Oh, well, right now, CBIZ is the only public accounting firm. You know, we're a New York Stock Exchange public company. CBIZ has been public for 25 years. We will not be the only one. You're going to see more accounting firms, especially the ones backed by PE. I would say in the next 2 years, somebody else is going to go public.
Wow.
I don't know whether it'll be Grant Thornton. I don't know whether it'll be Citrin Cooperman, who's on their second private equity owner. I don't know whether it would be Eisner Amper, who was the pioneer in bringing private equity to the public accounting space. But you will see more firms follow the CBIZ model, which is why we did our transaction with CBIZ, because we thought it was the end of the story.
Yeah.
But you will definitely, and I'm saying 2 years, maybe it's three, but you will certainly see accounting firms that have been owned by private equity. Somebody's going to take one of them public, and probably more than just one company. Mm-hmm. So I think 2021, when private equity discovered the accounting profession, was a watershed moment. And it will forever, for the better, change the profession for the people who work in it, the people who become partners or managing directors, for the clients. It's revolutionized what was an antiquated business model before that.
Mm. Jeff, are you such a passionate advocate for accounting? You can see the light in your eyes. This clearly switches you on. It's very much your blood. What excites you most for the next few years as we draw this interview to a close?
I really think it's the ability to attract and retain the talent we were having trouble attracting before. When I started in this profession, the options weren't the same as they are today. Wall Street was not like it was back in the 80s. There wasn't private equity firms back in the 80s. There wasn't technology firms. The top seven companies by market cap in this country may not have existed back then. And, you know, so we're competing for talent with people like Microsoft and Meta and Alphabet and PE-backed companies that pay people not only in cash, but they pay them in options. They pay them in stock grants. They have opportunities that as an accountant in 1981, I didn't have. So I think the change in the cap stack, the change in the equity stack in public accounting firms with the outside capital coming into the profession will allow us to be competitive with those other opportunities that people have. And, you know, accounting's always, I remember even to this day, 90% of the kids we hire out of college are gone by 5 years. It's become a training ground for other professions. Now that we have a different capital stack and we have different opportunities, maybe if the compensation looks more like it does in other places, like private equity-backed firms and stock, you know, public companies, if our compensation model looks more like those, maybe we won't lose the 90% and the best and the brightest, and they'll see a future. And accounting looks just like a technology company or a private equity backed company or a Wall Street investment bank, where the compensation is paid differently.
I sense a lot of hope.
Oh, I think it's a watershed moment. And I think it's ours to screw up as a profession.
Jeff Wiener, Markham, CBIZ, freelance consultant now to the world in everything that you're doing. It's been such a privilege to share some of your thoughts, your journey today on the Inside Public Accounting podcast. I've been your host, Rob Brown. We give you the stories, the personalities behind the numbers, and keep looking out for the surveys reports that we're putting out with Chelsea Summers and her team. Jeffrey, we thank you on behalf of the audience for your passion and your insights and your humility today. It's been a blast. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. It's been great being with you.